My last drink. Good morning, everybody. My name is Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is March 10, 1998, which is 25 years. Thank you. I have a home group. It's called the Free for Lunch Group. We meet at noon, 5 days a week, St. Mary Church campus in Helena. It's a pretty small town. You can find this. A big white roof has an interesting slope to it, and it looks like maybe alcoholics built it. But it's really artistic. It's a beautiful church, but that's where I go to meet. And we'd love to see you there. Get some feedback. I don't know.
Jeff needs things.
A little closer. Really? Oh, my. Okay. Try to modulate here. Okay. I also want to say that I love Al-Anon. I love it because of what Robbie said, that AA did save my life. Al-Anon is what saved our family. It really did. And I definitely feel like I'm not behind enemy lines. Even though there's this interesting isothermic cup, that's the one that keeps things warm, in our cabinet that says, call before you kill on it. And she must have got somewhere one of these things. But Al-Anon is really, really special, and places like this are really, really special. Kelly and I get to do this every now and again. Usually where we go to are conferences that are AA conferences with Al-Anon participation. This is one where it's Al-Anon with AA participation, and it's a real honor and it's a real special place that we get to be here. And Texas Recovery, family recovery, is something we got tapped into because a couple of Texans moved up to our neck of the woods and introduced us to this. So this feels like a second home. It's a wonderful place to be. And this is also, a theme for the conference that I really resonate with, inclusivity. Because I've been around meetings long enough to know that it's easy for me to get up, turn to my friends, talk to the people I know, and just get involved in all of that. When my real job there is to, shake the shaky hand of the newcomer, no matter what their condition is, no matter what their situation is in life, to make sure that I'm welcoming. Here's our snack table. Here are pamphlets. Here's where you want to sit. Please stay with us. We have things that might help you here. If they don't, fine, but we have things that can help you here. So I love that kind of inclusivity, and that came to me too. I remember being at a meeting fairly new. I forget what the topic was, I forget what I said, but I remember just sharing about my very, very busy head toward the end of the meeting, and people were laughing and laughing. And it was that good kind of laughter where I knew by their nodding that this was identification, I wasn't being laughed at. And somebody made a beeline up to me after that and said, man, you're one of us. Oh, no. But oh, yes. I mean, it was great to hear that and know that I was there and I was included and I'm one of us. And that's my simple job to do here before lunchtime, which is to tell you some things about how I am like one of us, my experiences before, what happened, and how I react to life now. And so I can start by telling you that I believed in alcoholism before I ever drank it for the first time. I believed in it. I came from a family, my parents were very young when they had me, they were 18. There was alcohol around all the time. But I come into a family where I'm basically being raised by kids, and they had more growing up to do before they had kids, but they hung together. They were very hardworking people, sullen people, sad a lot of the time. When I saw when they put that alcohol in their bodies, when they had friends over, when I saw them lighten up, loosen up, I knew there was a power in that bottle that I thought, I mean, that had my interest right away. I hadn't drunk it yet, but I'm already starting to develop this obsession before I even pick up. And I then see culture in fairly much a similar way. I would look at how culture came to me, and I would always have kind of an interesting focus on alcohol. So my grandmother took us to Dumbo one morning. My brother and I, it's a Disney animated classic that features drinking prominently. And one of the scenes, I don't know if you know Dumbo, but it's about a little elephant with big ears. And he can fly, and that saves the struggling circus. And so it's a perfect alcoholic story. It's a misfit with superpowers. There's this scene after a very successful performance where Dumbo flew and all of this, but they go into the clown's tent. After the clowns leave, there's like this big half barrel of champagne. You know, his friend Timothy the Mouse is drinking it. He sticks his trunk in there, starts drinking it, and he starts burping bubbles. And his eyes get all droopy and they get all goofy, and I just thought that was amazing. I just love that. You know? Now, I don't think Disney was promoting underage drinking. In fact, I know it doesn't. If you follow the rest of their evening, it turns into Pink Elephants on Parade. I mean, it's a cautionary tale about delirium tremens is what it is. I mean, it goes into these marching pink elephants, and it's really about a nightmare. But I see bubbles. And I knew that's the kind of thing I wanted. The way I played with kids was curiously focused around alcohol. I'm of an age where we would come home after school and we would watch first generation Star Trek with the intrepid Captain Kirk and the ultra logical Spock and the irascible but talented Dr. McCoy. And after we would watch, we'd get all inspired, we'd go outside, we'd want to have our own space adventures and our own games around this. And there would be fights about who got to be Captain Kirk and Spock and McCoy. And I was never in those fights. I wanted to be Scotty. Now, Scotty's an engineer, and his main role in the show dramatically is that when the ship is in trouble, make it go faster. And he would say, you know, she can't take it anymore, Captain. But somehow he would add his willpower and find a way to make it go faster and help save those grapes. But it's his drinking that's featured in several episodes that really got my attention. So there's one where the ship had been invaded by these aliens who could shapeshift, and they could make them look like the other members of the crew, and so all kinds of confusions and dangers come out of that. But then there's a scene where Scotty is face to face with his double, and they get into a drinking contest. Scotch, I imagine. One drinking, and you don't know which is which. But the one that passes out first, that's the alien. And so Scotty, he's my first sponsor. He taught me valuable life lessons. Like if you drink, you can keep the aliens away. If you try harder, apply some willpower, you can bend the laws of physics, save the Enterprise. So Scotty was kind of an early hero of mine. I also need to tell you, before I drink, I'm also somebody who has obsessions and secrets, even as a kid. I was always a reader, and I really liked biographies. I really liked other people's lives far more than my own. So there's one about Ben Franklin that I really liked a lot. I just read it over and over and over again. Later, I found out that Ben Franklin said, "Beer is evidence that God loves us and wants us to be happy." Wrong, Ben, at least for me. But I found this series when I was about fifth grade, and it was a series about classical composers like Mozart and Bach and Beethoven. And I was just fascinated by their lives, and I was pretty sure if my parents only bought me a harpsichord, I'd be a genius too. And I really want other people's lives. This is not wanting what you have, this is wanting to be somebody else. There's a early 20th century philosopher that would say, despair is wanting somebody else's life. And so you see this kid interested in biographies and things. You think that's kind of an interesting, maybe smart kid, but really it's just despair that I'm kind of going through. I'm just going to imagine being someone else. And I grew up in a home where there are two kinds of music, and it wasn't Mozart and Bach and that, it was boogie and it was woogie. I mean, that was all we had, all in our house was just rock and roll kinds of sounds. So anything else, please? And so I'm at the mall with my parents. My brother's at a sleepover. They give me some money to go shopping, and I find this record bin in one of the stores, and I see these records by Bach. And I'm fascinated, so I buy these records, and I get back with my parents, and I say, what did you buy? And I showed them Johann Sebastian Bach. And I don't know what was really going through their minds, but what it looked like was, ew.
Really?
And what I took from that, I mean, I imagine some kids are made of stronger stuff and could have that moment with their parents and think, oh, it's tough for you, I gotta go listen to Bach. But what I do is I think there's something wrong with what I just did, and there's something wrong with me. So I take those records home, and I don't listen to them for months. I just leave them in their cellophane wrappers. I just couldn't bring myself because I'm obviously wrong for wanting this, and I'm not very well put together, evidently, so I just don't listen. And then I come up with a plan. And the plan is this. Both my parents are working out of the home. My brother goes off to school. I could just pretend to be sick, stay home, and listen to these records while everyone else is away. So that way the shame wouldn't be there. I could just sort of hide this little thing over here. And that's what I did. I fake sick, my parents called in, I stayed home. I go to the stereo system, I start cranking some Bach. And I love it. I've never heard things like that before, and I thought it was amazing. I could feel an energy to it. I was moving around the house, I liked it. I loved it so much that I did the same thing the next day, and the next day. My memory was it was at least a week, maybe two, where I just stayed home, and my parents just called me out, and I just rocked a Bach, you know, for all that time. And eventually, I got bored, and I wanted to go back to school, see what they were doing. And so that's what I did. But you can see one of the lessons I took from that was if you really like something, you might be weird. And if you like it and you're weird, you better hide it so it's not that out there. And that's just how I started learning how to live life. It's gonna become very important later on when I find out I really like alcohol. In fact, none of what I've told you makes me an alcoholic, frankly. It's just an obsession. I read in Al-Anon literature that what you focus on, you magnify. And I had alcohol under a microscope. I was looking, I was focused on what alcohol might be able to do to me. But let's say I didn't have that physical allergy. What if a drink didn't taste like more? I don't know what I'd be doing. But I might not be here tonight or this morning. I would be somewhere else. You know, so it was ultimately that taste of more. That sense of release, which I found for the first time when I was 11. It was the first time I drank to get drunk. And I liked that effect right away. I liked feeling goofy. I liked feeling silly. I liked the levity of the whole thing, the perspective it seemed to give me. I even liked the hangover that came with it. After a couple hours, I was feeling that. And all that told me is I'm very much like my parents. They would not want us to make noises in the morning because they would tell us they had hangovers and their head hurt. So I knew what I was experiencing. And so, boy, I just felt like I'd arrived. I felt kind of grown up. And I did that. Now, as an 11-year-old who likes to drink, you typically have a supply chain problem. It's not the easiest thing to find, but basically I knew something about myself. But by 14 or 15, you know, it's on. I'm finding alcohol and I'm finding other stuff really, really regularly. And this inaugurates one of my two phases of active drinking. One is a wild and crazy phase, and the other is a very tame and absolutely delusional phase of alcoholism. But in the wild and crazy phase, I have my friends. Just do whatever we can find, booze, whatever else comes along. Then we get bored and we go on what we call search and destroy missions. If there was a car and you didn't lock the door, we'd boost it, steal from it. If there were windows not being attended, we'd break them. If we had spray paint, we had very vulgar, but we thought witty things to say, all in Arial font. Times New Roman is really hard in spray paint. So we did that, and I had a lot of second and inches kinds of things happening to me in that time. I borrowed a friend's Jeep at a party. It was near Christmas time. I find another friend. We go for a ride up in the foothills of Boise, Idaho, where I live, and it's like a 5,000-foot pass there. Going over there on icy, snowy roads, we spin out, flip the Jeep. I get thrown out. He's still in it. Goes down this hill. He's okay because he's buckled in. There's a big branch through the canvas top where I would have been if I had been in there. And I kind of think of myself as a light case, right? But that's what's happening to me. And we were okay. That's the good news. Not my Jeep. That's even better news. And we walk out of there, and just a cold, long walk, and we finally found someone who could take us back home. I didn't really suffer any consequences for that. I had other things happen. I was a very active kid. I loved skiing. I loved skateboarding. I wanted to be a surfer. But if you know anything about Boise, Idaho, there's a serious lack of ocean there. And so that wasn't going to happen. So just did the surfing. I did the skateboarding. I had some friends who were a little older than me, and they wanted to go to Southern California, where there were really good skate parks. And so I saved some money, and I wanted to go. I asked my parents, can I go? They said no. I went anyway. And I skate, and I do these other things, but I also get in a situation which would, back in the time, it'd be popular to look at the back of a milk carton and see the picture of a kid with missing over it. That could have been me from that time. So those are the kinds of things that are happening. And I come home from that event, and my friends think I'm some kind of bad runaway. I just feel weird inside from what happened and all of that. And I just keep rolling along. And I don't really have a direction of life. I'm bad at school. I don't care about that. I'm bad with anything that have to do with mechanics in my hands. I'm definitely not a Scotty. But drinking, drugging, that's the kind of thing I really wanted to do. And did, without much sense of direction. I didn't really keep jobs. I didn't really need jobs. My parents just sort of floated me along. My grandparents helped out, floated me along. And then I kind of get to my first real consequence, and it kind of ends the wild and crazy phase. It's a phase where I get arrested for DUI. And get taken down and fingerprinted and put in the hold, and I'm waiting there, and I finally get a chance to call my parents. I get bailed out, and I have a long walk home. I didn't know I could ask the bail bondsman for a ride or anything. I just had like an 8-mile walk, and so I'm walking home and thinking, my life's going nowhere. I got to do something about this. I got to stop smoking pot. So, glad you laughed at that. It seems like maybe some of you belong here. Yes, I've been drinking, but really, if I hadn't been out looking for weed, I wouldn't have been driving. If I hadn't been driving, I would have been caught for drunk driving, so it's the pot's fault, right? I would submit to you that line of thinking is not really thinking. It's like fantasy, it's like science fiction, it's rationalization is what that is. It's finding something, let's find something to focus on, but the real problem. It didn't occur to me that could be the real problem. The curious thing about that night is I was able to act on it. I did put away everything but the but the booze. And I was, I kind of lost interest in the surfing, skateboarding, skiing for a while, and I got really interested in running, I got really interested in triathlons, I started getting really fit. I start being successful at this thing called college that I hadn't been before. I'd taken like two or three, false runs and bouncing out, false runs and bouncing out. I just couldn't focus that long, had better things to do, I thought. But all of a sudden, I'm able to do that. So I'm getting fit. I'm finding some things I'm good at. And I'm starting into what I would call the tame and very delusional phase of my drinking. It was like at this moment, what I was saying is that when I looked at what I was doing in the past, that this must stop. This should stop. And what I meant by that is that the consequences should stop. The drinking should continue, but the consequences need to stop. So I tried so hard to just manage and control the consequences, right? So like, for instance, you get a DUI, it's because you have a car. So why not ride a bike everywhere? carry the booze with you. Of course, you can get arrested for that too, but you typically don't. You're typically running under the radar. But I did that, and I certainly had some, what one of my friends calls gravity storms on bikes. But it's also the riding and getting fit and everything that gets me to be pretty good at college, and I start working for the university newspaper, and later on I'm going to want to become a college professor. I like it so much. But in that process, I'm covering this student action group, and there's this amazing, cute redhead, blue eyes, flashing smile, and it turns out she's really fun to talk to, and she's in the front row. Not taking notes. This is growth. Right, and so we just hit it off, and we start having a lot of fun. I just felt more at home and talking to Kelly than anyone else I knew, and it was all great. I take a little detour named Karen. I don't know why I did that, but it wasn't as fun. Come back to Kelly, and we start going off on this thing. This has to be what, 1983, 84, and. We get very serious, and we start talking about the M word, the merger. we weren't really mature enough to talk about marriage. We wanted to talk about it like it was some kind of corporate merger, the Parsley Morris merger. But we were looking at that, and there was about a week before I was going to ask her to merge. That she asked me some really stupid questions. First question she asked, do you remember that time you told me that there's times when you don't drink that much and there's times where you drink a lot? I'd say, yeah. And the second question is even dumber. Well, when are those times that you don't drink a lot? I don't know what I said, but she seemed to accept it. I really don't. But what that does is like the 3x5 note cards, it's like I just turned the corner down on that one. She's watching. And if I like something a lot and it makes me weird, hide it. So even before we merge, and a week later she says yes, but even before we merge, there's something right in the middle of our relationship which I now know is alcoholism. I know that today. I didn't know that then, but there it was. So, as intimate as we could be, sure. But it wasn't ever that complete until I met people like you in rooms like this, where it got better. So we merge. I want to go to graduate school. We pack off to Pennsylvania. We go there, and we have a lot of good years. We have a lot of fun. We study hard. We play hard. We fall in with a group of rock climbers. We're having those kinds of adventures, and things are just kind of delightful and fun for quite a long time. But kind of toward the end of that run, because if you keep doing well, they will graduate you. That's what was going to happen. And then we decided, well, we want to start a family. We both wanted kids. And so we have them. we have twins. And Kelly goes on bed rest about 22 weeks into that. And I was trying to be the, you know, kind of the sensitive, supportive husband. Well, since she can't drink alcohol with a pregnancy, I shouldn't drink. That was really hard. It did not work. But it was also really interesting. When she went on bed rest, it was going to be me doing the cooking and the cleaning and her and helping around the house, all that kind of stuff that she would do part of it, I would do part of it. When I was going to end up doing all that, she said, oh, you know, Jeff, you better go back to drinking. Oh, really? Sure. I was having so much fun not. So, yes, of course, I did. And but again, there wasn't a lot of honesty there. But we have these twins, and it was getting really hard to keep together with that. Just the fear of that. I'm going off to try to find a job, and it's very, very competitive trying to get work doing the kinds of things that I'm doing. Very, very hard. And the odds aren't good that you make it in your first, your second, your third year. A lot of PhDs out there who just don't get to find a tenure track line. So I'm full of fear. How am I going to keep the family together? How am I going to, be a good provider? How am I going to be a good husband, a good father, all of this stuff? And I'm not talking to anybody about this. I can't even talk to Kelly about this. There's just fear and there's alcohol, fear and alcohol throughout all of that. But I do find a job and we end up moving to Helena, Montana, where I could catch alcoholism, as it turns out. Because it's there that I heard you. I mean, our life got horrible. I mean, we burnt things to the ground with the fighting, abuse, physical, mental, emotional. It was just, it was on. We had something of a dance where we would fight hard and I would either sometimes leave, oftentimes more likely I was kicked out. And I'm new at this work, and I'm around a lot of smart people. I don't feel like I'm one of them. And I would go sleep in my office. You know, I had a pillow there, I had a blanket there. I had a pint or a fifth wrapped up in that blanket. I had changes of underwear, changes of socks. It's pretty humiliating when you like to think about it now. But I would go do that. But at least there I could drink like I wanted to drink. I could maybe do a little bit of work. I'd have to run from the security guard at night, you know, because I wouldn't need to use the restroom or something. You know, they keep track of who's in those buildings at night. I'm 31. I'm a professor, and I'm still running from the cops. So that's kind of how it was. And I would think about how bad it was. I'd also think, I hate her, I hate her, I hate her. How do I get back there? You know, how do I get back to the big bed, as we call it? So we have that happening, and it gets to a place where Kelly's kind of like waving the flags and saying, look, there's something really, really wrong here. And at this point, I just got to say, I love Al-Anon. I know you're crazy too. You try to force solutions and become irritable and reasonable without knowing it. But I gotta say this too. You have more data. We use stuff. We use alcohol, maybe other things. We bliss out, we brown out, we out. But I have to really think about that differently after what Anna shared. Thank you, Anna, for what you shared. About the emotional blackout, you know. But at the same time, I still think you have more data than I did. What Kelly remembers is her saying that, you know, Jeff, we need some help. And what I said evidently was, you know, that's right, you need help. You should go. I don't remember that. But here's what I remember. Maybe it wasn't that night, maybe it was another night, but it was this. Sorry, Kelly. This is just as good as it gets. This is as good as it gets. And there's reasons for that. I watched my granddad good, hardworking radiologist in Boise, Idaho. Go to work every day, bring home the paycheck, and come home, do a shift from like 5 a.m. to 3 p.m. Come home, drink, take a nap. While my grandma sought mental health help, mood stabilizers, and one day I go over just to say hi, and she's being down, going down the stairs in a gurney into the ambulance. Suicide, overdose, I don't know what it was. I was scared. I remember that. And my granddad dies of liver disease at the age of 71. My grandmother always said it was a non-alcoholic form of liver disease. I believe my grandma. Also interesting, at that time, there was a needlepoint that appeared in her now smaller house that said, God, grant me the serenity, right? Things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, wisdom to know the difference, a nice needlepoint. And I remember my 19-year-old wisdom looking at that saying, cleverly put. Not that deep. Today it runs my life. But you know, so yeah, that was happening. My dad was an attorney. He drank hard, not always at home. My parents fought about that all the rest of their lives. And but he still put a roof over our heads. There was still always food on the table. Most of the time the bills got paid. He drank like that. My mom sought psychiatric help, took various kinds of mood stabilizers, antidepressants, things like that. And she goes off to mental health facilities. So when it comes to us, it's not looking good for Kelly. I mean, I have a solution. I have what I need. I have all this ick inside, and I just need to pour alcohol in, and I'm fine. At least for a little while, until the fighting starts, or the despair starts, or the fear starts, the shakes, whatever's happening the next morning. But man, thank God for that suffering, you know? Because at that time, she's the enemy, right? What you have taught me, and what makes you so very interesting and very attractive to me, is that you're really the friends. You're really the allies. You're really the support. You just can't burn through the delusion that's there a lot of the time, and maybe we don't want it yet. But at any rate, you know, she's saying that, and she does go get help, and I just keep doing what I'm doing, and finally she does talk me into going that, and I finally get to a counselor on my own, because we're too unhealthy for marriage counseling, as it turns out. Kelly will clarify that this evening. And so I'm starting to work with this guy, and what he's doing with me is what we would call in our program zero stepping. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it mentions that if you're not sure you're an alcoholic, go out and try some controlled drinking. It might be worth a bad case of jitters to get full knowledge of your condition. And so he told me, no more than two, and never alone. Well, that should work. For a couple months, it kind of did. We just bought our second home one night, and I was sanding wood floors the whole day, and I had been following the approved plan of drinking. And then after that day of sanding down wood floors, I was just tired. I was cranky. I didn't know if I was doing a good job. Actually, I know I wasn't doing a good job. And that night, I just start hammering on a bottle of Jack Daniels and just drinking it hard. And Kelly comes up and gives me a hug. And she says, that's okay, I'm sick too. Wow. At that moment, I just thought, oh my God, we really do need help. And we are clutching each other, but we are going down. We are drowning. And was my feeling of the whole thing. My current sponsor, who works both a very strong Al-Anon and AA program, came up to me one time when I shared that. And he said, do you know the amount of love that took for her to do that, to say that? Do you know how much love was in that? And I think I would have to say, no, I didn't realize that. I do now. But that never occurred to me. You know, how much commitment there is there in love. So at any rate, I do that. And that next day I had an appointment with a counselor, and I said, I broke the rules, and I'm really jittery right now. And he said, well, here's the right consequence for it, and that is you go get yourself an evaluation from an addictions counselor, because he doesn't do that kind of work. He doesn't know. It's a different thing. Okay. And that's the grace happening to me before I even get to AA, is I start saying, okay. I probably didn't have to listen to him, right? He would have taken my money. He would have tried to work with me, I think, for a while. But I said, okay. And I got to that addictions counselor, and he did what he does, and he said, I think you're an alcoholic, I think you're an addict, I think you should work with me, I think you should go to AA. I said, okay. So I started working with him, started learning more about my practices, my responses to life, my attitudes. I'm not with you yet. He keeps saying, gone to AA yet? I kept saying, no. Go to AA. Okay. Gone to AA yet? No. And I had a solid reason for not going, I think. I did not want to go to AA because there were people there. I was pretty sure there were going to be people there. I just wanted to work with this trained person and not go. But I do end up there eventually, because there's no reasoning with someone like that. And so I do finally go, or try to go anyway. And so at this time, we're still going to church. We're trying to look good at least for 1 hour a week and figure out something. And what I know from the bulletin at that church is that there was an AA meeting in Monday, Wednesday, Fridays called Free for Lunch in somewhere on that campus. And so I thought, I didn't know that this is non-affiliation, that they're just renters. But I thought, well, wouldn't this be good? Put together this religious thing with that thing, whatever that is, I'll roll that way. And so one Wednesday, I tried to go find that meeting. And so I go, there are two buildings on that campus. They both have a top floor and a basement. Instinctively, I know to go to the basement. Don't know what that is with us, but, you know, closer to hell, maybe. I don't know. But we go down there. So I go down to the basement, and I find this little side chapel. There are four people, gray hair, looking really sad. I figure it must be in the right place. I mean, this looks miserable. So I sit down. I don't say anything. They don't say anything. They look at me. I look at them. Is this what AA is? I mean, just dare each other to go steal the sacramental wine? I mean, what do we do here? And then the priest walks in, all geared up for a service. And so when the priest walks in, they stand up, I stand up. He starts a song, we sing the song. And yeah. I walked into Mass, and it was a memorial Mass. His name was Stan. So I sit there the whole time. I mean, they're looking at me strange, because how did he know Stan? And the priest is looking at me kind of funny. He's like, what's he doing here? I see him on Sundays with his loving, nice family. But I stay there and, you know, pray for the repose of Stan's soul. Because if I were to get up and move, they'd know I was going to the other basement. I gotta stay there, because so much shame and guilt around this whole drinking thing and this whole not being able to put together a life thing, that if I got up and moved, they would know. I'm just making stuff up at this point, right? So I do, but I leave there. In a curious way, Stan helps me get to you guys. I leave there just mad at myself, just with the secrecy, with the shame, with the guilt. I got to do something about this. So I find a number in our newspaper to call. I call. I find a meeting that night. Very different scene. People talking to each other. Lovely smell of coffee in the air. There's literature there. They start a meeting. I sit down for my first AA meeting. I'm probably over 60 days at that point. I've been that far into working with this dependence counselor, and I'm really kind of liking it. I feel lighter. I feel cleaner. What we talk about is, you know, feeling better, working better, having a better time is kind of what was going on. But I'm getting to you finally. And they say, is anyone here, as we often do for a first meeting, and raise my hand. They welcome me and clap a little bit. And they say, is anyone here with, they go through the birthdays part, and they say, anyone here with 30 days of sobriety? And I raise my hand, and they clap and give me a coin. And anyone here with 60 days? And they clap a little less enthusiastically. What's going on here? And I'm loving AA. I mean, it's my first meeting. I've bagged 2 medals. And I'm thinking, this is great. And and what's more important is that I love the meeting. My head was clear. I see some of those people today. I remember faces in the room. That's not often an experience of somebody's first meeting. But I was awake enough. And when they would just share in this very matter-of-fact way about living in a small trailer in the Big Belt Mountains outside Helena, Montana, and thinking of shooting themselves, I thought, man, they can talk with such honesty about their situation. I can't do that yet. I want that. I want to be that comfortable in myself. When I heard somebody named Brenda talk about the car at high school, if you don't know about the car is when there's an assembly you're skipping, or you're at lunchtime and you go off to the car and you get on board what you need to get through the rest of the afternoon of freaking high school. I knew that car, maybe not her car in a different town, but I knew that car, man. And so I knew I was hearing truth. I knew I was hearing what was good. I knew this was cool. I wanted to stay. We get to the end, there's the Lord's Prayer and all that. And then something really, really awful happened, which I knew was gonna happen, because there's people there. 3 of them come up to me, just kind of grinning. I didn't know they wanted to work with a newcomer. Inclusivity, right? I didn't know that. Everything in me says, get out of here. Run. This is way too frightening. All of a sudden, I'm back into the other mode where I just can't do this. They wanted to sell me a book. I like books. I bought the book. I said, I'll read it. And I went. And I thought, but I was scared, but this was cool. I liked it. I'll go back next week. If somebody said 90 meetings in 90 days or get a sponsor, I think I did not hear that. So I thought I'd just go back like I would do any other kind of, you know, weekly professional appointment. And so I started going back, and I didn't really know what we did there. I was lost and loose in AA for a long time. But in that process, I thought what we were supposed to do is people tell their stories and we give advice. I quickly learned that's not what we do either. But I just kept running away right after the meeting was over, and I wasn't meeting anybody. And my addictions counselor was saying, no one's taking out for coffee or anything? And no, I mean, it's just going. And he says, well, all right. But then I realized it's because I'm getting out of there so fast. So they said at this particular meeting, you know, if you're a home group member, please stay up afterward and put away chairs. I don't know what a home group is, but I know how to put away chairs. So I put away chairs, and it gave me very good social skills to say things like, nice meeting, huh? I like what you said. And I also found out I could ask questions, because they kept talking about a program. They kept talking about program this, program that, program, program, program. And so I asked this guy after the meeting, you guys keep talking about a program here, what's the program? And he looks at me with this grin and his smile, and he says, ah, it is that which works when you work it. And I just would smile and said, thank you. And I walk away thinking in my head, thanks, Zen Master. I have no idea what that means. So I asked this other guy. I say, you keep talking about a program. What's a program? And he says, it's the steps. And he walks away from me. There's no talking to you guys. I hate you. But I love you. And both of them turn out to be right, by the way. They love you. And then I realized, as much as I think I'm a good reader, I mean, I actually try to teach people to read better. I realized, I mean, it says, and John read it this morning. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Oh, man. And I really read them for the first time and realized, oh, I'm going to need some help with this. At this time, I am going to that other meeting at where my church is. And I know I'm going to need help. And there's this guy there who just seems very, very insightful, seems to know the disease. We seem to share a bond in some way, has a great idea of God. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. And his name is Scotty. Not of the Enterprise, but he was a veterinarian. And so he starts taking me through the steps. You know, we talk, I tell him how I drink. He says, yeah, you're one of us, come along. He says, you know, he can't come to believe in a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity. Well, I have some problems there, some slight problems there. You see, my idea of God is sort of like the human resource director at work who can't put your name and your face together but has your file. And so very, very distant from any kind of God that could possibly restore me to sanity. God just doesn't work at this level. Somewhere at that time, maybe it was my addictions counselor gave me this worksheet. There's space on that worksheet on step two to write about your conception of God. I start writing. There's not enough space here. But man, I started reading what I wrote. It's like, you sad, deluded man. You have no clue. I better just listen to Scotty. I better just listen to the people in the room because they clearly have this connection. And at least I was coming to believe in that. Next, step three. We get to step three. And it, you know, made a decision to turn your will and life over to the care of God. Yes, okay, go on, step four. Here are the columns, here's everything, and I bogged down. And Commander Scott tells me, if you're struggling on the step you think you're on, go back to the one before. And I realized that third step prayer, I never really knew it. I didn't really say it. I don't really have a connection with that. I said over and over again every night for days. And all of a sudden something shifted in me. And there was a presence, there was a sense, which I believe in today is a spiritual experience that has not ended ever since. Could be nerves, but there it was. And next day I start my fourth step, you know. And the deeper you go, the higher you fly. I'm getting all that stuff down, talking to my sponsor about it. We spent very little time on six and seven. We get to eight and nine and on the go. But I got to tell you, as I'm getting better in that first year and doing all of that, things at home are still really, really bad. Really bad. It was the hardest year of our marriage, probably. It was the year after I stopped drinking. There's just so much anger, you know, so much venom. And my sponsor was really great in getting me into the family afterward, where I could realize that the whole family is sick. And I could realize that maybe I just caused too much damage here, ultimately, you know, because it does say things in the language of the 30s. You know, that the head of the household knows he's much to blame. The father knows he's much to blame. Whatever it is, whatever gender, I am much to blame. And so, you know, it just gets so bad that I think after a while, it'd be better if we just end this thing. So instead of the M word we're talking, you know, I'm thinking D word. And I move out, which is different than going to live in your office. I actually have a couple friends at that point. I say, things aren't good at home. Can I move in with you? I'll pay rent. And I move out. And I didn't do that with a plan that would get Kelly to Al-Anon. I just did it because I thought, it's just over. We got to find something different to do. But it gave her the space and the ability and the grace to find you guys. Thank you for being there. When she got there, she'll tell you all about that tonight. And through that whole process, you know, we now had something of a common track to go down. We had a common language. It's very much like, in so many words, that we were just two people clutched together like that last night of my drinking. And we were drowning. And it's like AA said, let go of her, swim over to shore, find us. And it's like they said, Kelly, let go of him, swim to shore, find us. And then we can meet on shore. Then we can say, hey, there's some bushes over there. But More importantly, yes, it's the start of the of all kinds of intimacy, the emotional intimacy, the physical intimacy, the spiritual intimacy. It's there in ways that wasn't before, and our house gets very peaceful. It becomes a place where we can love, where we can laugh, where our kids can find a fairly stable place to go, where there isn't so much anger and there isn't so much venom. It gets to be a peaceful place where we could all just get there and study. Kelly and I have very flexible work in our hours, so we'd meet together for coffee before we picked up the kids. She'll tell you more about that tonight. And we began to basically be able to talk to each other in ways we hadn't been able to talk for a long, long time. Because one of the things I've loved most about life is talking to Kelly. And things got really, really good. We lived in that same house where I was standing in the wood floors, the same house where I had my last drink, and we lived there for 20 years. When we moved, we had the open house. We weren't there, of course, but the realtor afterward said, you know, when people went through this house, it's just a little house, they said, when people went through the house, they said, you know, the people who lived here, they were happy. That they could sense that from the house is testament to you guys. It's testament to you. That we could have a house that had joy that you could somehow palpably feel and want to talk about. And maybe it would be something they would want. So they did. And so I could end with saying happy ever after at that point, right? But it wasn't. I mean, we moved in 2018. Kelly's diagnosed with breast cancer not long after we moved into this new house. And all of a sudden, it was almost back to year one. Because, I mean, there's sort of a story around breast cancer that, you know, everyone's going to rally and fight and wave the pink, and there's nothing wrong with any of that. But Kelly was mad. Mad. And I was not ready for that. I was surprised. I didn't know what to do with it. Some of it coming at me. You're not going to want to be here. You're not good at helping. You know, I mean, I was hearing things about myself after 20 years. Whoa. And so all I knew is to hang on to AA, go to my sponsor, here's what's going on, what is this? But what I also knew is this isn't really Kelly, this is the fear talking, this is something else. So I didn't leave. I was as helpful as she'd allow me to be as much as I could. I would do my best to listen to her and what she was going through. At one point she was able to say, you know, the best thing you were able to do in that time was just hear me. And I think I was able to hear her pretty well at that time. But it really felt like there was, you know, angry at God. It felt like no joy was going to be back in our lives again. And now there's joy back, but it took a while. It took space. We had to find new ways of consolation and new ways of finding forward. It was very interesting where Kelly found it. She found it in art. She found it in painting. She found it first in loving these painters, one of which is named Johannes Vermeer in the 17th century. And we started watching all this art history documentaries together just to share it. And then right after that, I mean, the pandemic hits, and she says, you know what, we should try some paint by numbers. And I've learned a long time ago, always try to say yes to a Kelly adventure. And so she said paint by numbers, and so she gets these two, we order these two paint by numbers, and she's doing hers, and I'm doing mine. I hate it more than I can tell you. But she finds something that works for her, and now our house is filled with lovely paintings that she's done. And I just think it's marvelous what she's done. And we've come back to where we could travel, and we have had time to go to different kinds of countries. We had a chance to go to the Netherlands recently, and we didn't know this. We had scheduled a trip. Kelly said, what if I told you the tickets were this? Right. We go. And what we did not know is that her most meaningful artist, there was going to be a lifetime retrospective, once-in-a-lifetime chance to see almost all of his paintings at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And so it just fell in. And we bought these little passes, friends' passes, to the museum. It allows you to go not once, not twice, but as often as you want. We went like 11 times. And we would sit in front of these paintings and just hold each other and cry. Because of what that meant, a new way of going forward in our lives. And then every so often, one would not have people around it. We'd say, bonus round, let's go back to that one. And we'd go and look at it again and just marvel at this amazing stuff. And that's kind of how we roll now. The last thing I want to say, I know you're thinking lunch, and anyway, told you a little bit about that health stuff. I got to also end by saying this last year, I had a tough time. I mean, I woke up in the middle of the night in summer, and just got up, and my head just started spinning. Spinning. I could not walk. I was nauseous. And I thought, I used to drink to get to this? My God. But it was hammering me, and I was scared, you know, and I have 10 years of ski patrol experience, so I'm thinking, I should diagnose myself for shock or for stroke, you know, and I'm trying to do this diagnosis. I don't think I have a stroke, but I really think I have a stroke, and I wake Kelly up, and the people in the EMT and ambulance say that they think it might be heart attack, and we just don't know. It was vertigo, so ultimately it's not that big of a deal as it turns out, but it felt like a really big deal when it was happening. And so get to the hospital, and they're getting ready to run tests. I don't know what's going to happen to me. We don't even know what it is yet. Kelly kind of knows, actually. She's really good at diagnosing stuff. But all I could do is, what if this is it? I just hold her hand, and I can barely talk. This is such a strong feeling. And I just said, you know, I just remember saying that if this is all I get, it was a blast. It was a blast. And it's really good to know that's my verdict on life. That's my verdict on life. This has been a blast. And it's been a blast being up here tonight. Today. It's usually at night, so I'm just saying that. Great to be with you this morning. Now noon, now you go get lunch. I just want to say thank you. This is a bonus round. Thank you very much.